Welcome to Close Listening, WPS1's program of readings and conversations presented in collaboration with Penn Sound. Our guest today is Richard Foreman. Richard Foreman has written, directed, and designed over 50 of his plays, both in New York City and in Europe, mostly through his own ontological hysteric theater. Five of his plays have received Obie Awards as the best play of the year, and he's received five other Obies for directing and for sustained achievement. His most recent productions are Zomboid and The Gods Are Pounding My Head, a.k.a. Lumberjack Messiah. My name is Charles Bernstein. Richard, welcome to Close Listening.
Hello, Charles.
If you had to pick one thing, what would you say is the biggest change in sensibility between your earliest work, say, of the 70s, and what you're working on, even in the last 10 years, not necessarily just the last couple of pieces?
The biggest change probably was that I sold out a little.
Sold out by continuing to work in your own small theater?
No, sold out by, at a certain point, my work, but this was quite a while ago, started becoming a little more assimilatable by audiences. In other words, in the early days, I was really very austere and rigorous, and two-thirds of the audience would walk out after half an hour, and I thought that was great. It proves that I was making real art that people weren't ready for. And then I started being involved with Kate Manheim, who I'm married to now and who was the star of my plays for many years, and she was not an intellectual like I was, and she used to say, "Oh, Richard, this is so boring. I want to do things more like what I like is I Love Lucy." So she insisted on putting more dancing and funny stuff in the plays, which actually was probably pretty healthy for me and expanded what I do, and I'm eternally grateful for that. She stopped acting about 10 years ago, I don't know, and I think I'm slowly now pulling back to being the glummer, more intellectually oriented Richard, who's making theater in a more minimal way. And that tendency, only in the last 2 years, has increased with my move, this new idea. I always claim I had, you know, most artists have one idea in their life. I finally had a second idea. I've been looking for it for 35 years. And that was to integrate these filmed backdrops, these slow bas-relief tableau vivants at the back of my plays. And it sort of is pulling me into a more meditative structure. So that's a big change.
Do you think, though it's impossible to actually have this in reality, that if you represented your early work, say, right at your ontological space at St. Mark's, and you just did one of those, say, this month, that audiences would have that same reaction?
Oh, it's really hard to say. I sort of suspect. I mean, those plays, the form of those plays was like five lines of dialogue that's as they were presented slowly by the actors on stage, were echoed at an even slower speed on tape, and they would build up so you just hear. They started out being followable and then became this word salad, and then there would be a loud explosion. There'd be a pause. The actors would adjust a little, another find for six lines of dialogue, and that went on slowly, hour after hour. So it might be hard for people to take. I don't know.
How long was the longest of the work? You're talking about the early 70s.
Oh, well, not that long, maybe 2.5 hours.
And now you tend to stay around an hour.
Yeah, a little over an hour.
And yet, when I started to see the work in the mid-70s, it was tremendously appealing and entertaining. Mm-hmm. I wrote it in Potato Land and Egyptology at the Public Theater,
well,
which
I'm
is still relatively early. But you're tracing this change even to the late 70s.
Well, when
then.
Kate got into the plays, it was when, like, Wrote in Potato Land was like the fourth or so, fifth play that Kate was in. And I think that had a real influence. But also maybe deep down, even though I didn't want to admit it to myself, deep down inside, maybe I didn't like the idea that everybody was walking out. You know, after a couple of years, enough was enough.
But you've always had a vaudevillian aspect to your work, very explicitly sometimes, but also, I mean, because it's thematized, but also, you know, in just the theatrical sense. I mean,
yes.
You're certainly a person of the theater. When sometimes you talk about your austerity and your minimalism, I think all your works have that connection.
Of course, because I'm interested in not denying anything that passes through me, any of the garbage of this culture that I live in. And part of the garbage is all kinds of vaudevillian and you know, other low-down stuff that I can respond to appropriately as much as anybody else. But in a way, I hate myself for responding, I suppose. In the early days, people used to say to me, "Well, Richard, you start out a wonderful dance, but then you stop it abruptly in the middle of a loud buzzer. Why don't you let us enjoy it?"
And yet the buzzers were for me very appealing.
Of course.
Are appealing. And when you had in some of that early stuff, a sword, I remember, would come down from from the ceiling, and you're there operating the machinery of the production. All of that at the same time is very rigorous and self-conscious, but it's also quite entertaining.
Charles, that's true. I think so also. But of course, let's remember one thing. You and I are not normal theatergoers.
Or even normal people, maybe.
Right.
It is true that I find that what's supposed to be entertaining in the theater and on Broadway really excruciating.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike popular movies, for example, which I like and enjoy, or TV, which I very much enjoy, I actually find conventional theater excruciating.
Well, I've been going to conventional theater, lately, for the last 15 years, I don't go to things, I've had it. But from the time I was 15 to the time I was 40, I went to see absolutely everything. And I always used to leave the theater saying, what is the use? I mean, if that's what they want, I can't possibly make a success in the theater because that's so awful. They like it. Yeah.
In the piece that you read on the first show that was about Zomboid, you make the distinction between ideas and reality, which is a sort of old-time poetics, or at least old-time New American poetics,
mm-hmm.
new-time, old-time. But it interests me very much, that dichotomy. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, but I realize, a dinosaur. I mean, I'll be 69 in a few days.
And we all know that in the 1930s, the dinosaurs roamed lower New York.
Yes.
Tyrannosaurus Rex and all that.
You know, I believe in, I sort of come out of high modernist art. And the question is ideas versus reality. Well, you know, who was I just reading the other day who said that the thing about reality is if you go to reality, there is not inside of reality itself any explanation or justification of reality. You have to go elsewhere. Well, you can go to the realm of ideas, you can go to mysticism, you can go to what have you. But there is a difference. Reality does not explain itself. I'm not sure that ideas explain reality either successfully, but reality does not explain itself. And I find that maddening, scary, and I deal with that problem in my work, which is, I think, chock full of reality, but presented in such a way that it is facing the audience, as indeed I used to and still do have actors often facing the audience. In essence, the play is saying, audience, here is a tiny bit of reality. What do you do with this? What use do you make of it? And that demand is a demand that I find energy-giving and exhilarating. And that's what I want from life, that kind of demand at every moment. Richard, what use do you make of this? And that's the area in which I operate.
A big difference between what you do and another kind of theater, especially that would say that it's moral, that it's good for you, that it's elitist, and that would criticize popular culture. And of course, here I'm thinking again of your piece that you wrote on Zomboid. Is that you don't hold out what's good for you as being the nature of what the experience is. It's about the, you call it mental gymnastics. It's about working through the experience. And yet you kind of come close to arguing for a moral value to the art. And yet I think you're at the opposite end from the idea of art as being, you know, uplifting, giving you morally good ideas. And it has to do with the difference, I think, between ideas versus experience.
Yes, it's also the old cliche discussion of how a teacher can't really teach you anything but can just present you with the opportunity to find out for yourself. So I've always believed that art simply has to be isomorphic with a certain process that I think is healthy. Art has to immerse you in everything that is problematic and troubling about the world, and sort of through its compositional strategies teach you how to take all these garbage-like elements and yet learn to sing and dance in a kind of Blakean way, celebrating your collision with all these elements, your absorption of all these elements, your refusal to deny these elements, but organizing them in a new way that gives energy and delight.
Now, let's talk about the garbage-like elements that you speak of. And, I mean, do you feel that all aspects of popular culture are garbage-like elements? Because actually, even against the kind of moralistic theater, which I think in a lot of ways your work has always rejected the kind of Broadway, you know, theater of ideas. We have Clifford Odets now revived, for example. I've never heard you talk about Clifford Odets, but that'd probably be a good, again, 30s example. You revel in lots of things that seem to come from popular culture, from a range of different kinds of references, and it doesn't seem like you're any more negative about aspects of popular culture than you are about aspects of political culture or high culture. So it seems to me when you talk about elitism, it isn't the elitism of a certain conception of high culture that the modernists, some of the modernists, would have had.
Well, it is more than one might think, because I consider myself, as practically everybody that I know, to be a fallen human being. I have my feet in the mud, and I enjoy, less these days than I used to, but certainly I have lusted for all kinds of pop culture things.
You've lusted in your heart for popular culture.
Yes. And yet, in the end, I feel like I feel when I've eaten too much chocolate cake. And, you know, I too am vulnerable, but I do think that in a way, it doesn't do me any good. But I'm a but my task in life, as most of our tasks, is to live the tension between the paradise that we dream of and the reality in which we find ourselves. It's very interesting. I, you know, working on this film project that is involved with my theater, I was in Portugal last week, and I have a partner in the project, and we each film for a couple of days by ourselves, our own material. And I was sitting there. We were actually filming in an old mental institution in Lisbon. And I was sitting there watching her film. And I was watching all the people running around. And, you know, people would do things. And she would pat them on the back. And everybody's eyes were aglow. And they were all trying together to make art. And being very turned on by that. Which, of course, is classically the definition of this collaborative effort that is making theater or making film. And I realized, sitting there in the grass watching them work, oh my God, I turned totally against this. What popped into my head was, and I spoke to them about this, you know, we've all seen cartoons where the little cartoon character is singing and dancing, and he's so happy, and all the little houses on the street develop smiling faces and sort of turn and look down at him and dance along with him. And I thought, you know, when I've learned things, when I've been opened to the truth, it seems to me, imagine that cartoon where here I am and all of a sudden all the houses on the street and the trees, instead of turning and smiling to me, they turn away from me and they bend away from me. And somehow that is the personification of the kind of inside experience that I have found most valuable in my life. And that is the me who rejects popular culture.
I'm talking with Richard Foreman on Close Listening here on WPS1.org. You spoke of yourself as fallen. Fallen is, I guess, a pretty famous Christian image of the sinner.
Yeah.
How do you relate to that religious conception of the fallen or to other religious ways of grappling with human beings' guilt or fallenness?
I tend to believe that we've been sold a bill of goods, and I mean psychologically, spiritually, and we are leading lives in which we are detached from the truth. Now, years ago, I used to feel very guilty that, you know, I was making art instead of going off and finding a guru. I didn't feel that guilty, but I used to think, how come I just don't go off and find a guru and become an enlightened person? And I don't really trust that either. I mean, people who, you know, join movements and spend their lives blissed out somehow is not my thing either. So I don't know. I'm confused. I'm happy to say that I'm confused. I often imagine, will I be able to get to into my deathbed? And what I would like to be able to say on my deathbed is not, yes, I've understood. I want to say on my deathbed, you know, I just didn't understand. And now I'm going into death where I will maybe not understand more. Or I'm happy with not being able to answer those questions or resolve those issues, and that's what drives me to make art.
And yet you speak about a Blakean ecstatic dimension. Mm-hmm. You speak about paradise. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you providing guru-like glimpses for the audience in your work?
Yeah, but don't trust me, because it's just postcards. It's just intimations of that. You know, it's not the real thing.
Is there a way to get closer to that real thing?
Well, obviously, you're sitting across the table from you is not an enlightened person. So I'm the wrong person to ask. I'm just, where am I? What am I doing? Something's wrong. Maybe I'll do something in art here that, I don't know, will orient me a little better.
I want to come back one more time to the use of the term elitist, which meant to be very provocative in your piece, as indeed what you've been saying here. A lot of the reason that people reject the concept of elitism, it doesn't actually have to do with what you're putting forward as elitist, I think, but has to do with the idea that it's a kind of social or class thing, that it excludes people.
Of course.
And that isn't actually, and you say that in the piece, but I still think it's worth going into in more detail. The kind of elitism you're talking about is not meant to be excluding people based on ethnicity, race, class.
Oh, of course not. But the real world is such that I am aware of the fact that in a certain sense it must, because unless you have received a certain kind of education, not only in school, but unless life has knocked you around in a certain way that makes you open to all kinds of languages that are not the normal operative languages, you're going to reject what I do. Now, most of my life I've thought of myself as a person of the left who wants to make the world better. But I realized very early on, well, realized is a pretentious word, I sort of concluded very early on that to make so-called progressive art, where you tell people about a bad situation and urge them to move to change it, has two built-in problems. Number one, years ago I went to see a specific movie in France, an Italian movie called The Working Class Goes to Heaven, about people in a factory and how they were exploited by the bosses. And you walked out of the movie thinking, my God, something's got to be done. But I did not then go and join a guerrilla group and start bombing bosses' houses. I had to go on and live my life, as I think most people who saw that movie did. So somehow you have to assimilate that upset, and it becomes like a shot of toxin to protect you against yellow fever. It sort of thickens the skin in the long run, I believe, as horrible as that sounds. The other thing is, to be really progressive, you have to free people from the language, from the worn-out language that uses all kinds of words, love, democracy, freedom, that are encrusted with all kinds of bad habits, bad ways of interpreting those, putting you in the prison of the language as it exists. And to use a new language that frees you from that mental prison is to be hard to understand because you're not using the ongoing language. But we have to be freed from the language just like we have to be freed from the social system that oppresses us. So it's very tricky dealing with the fact that, yeah, in a way you're going to be making elitist art if you're using a language that is a language that suggests free ways of using the head.
Well, there's the famous H.L. Mencken remark that for every problem there's a simple solution, simple and wrong. Difficult problems may demand difficult art. The issue of elitism, and you're addressing it directly, what I'm asking, though, doesn't necessarily have to do with education or going to an elite, having an elite education, because I would say, and this program's co-sponsored by an elite school, the University of Pennsylvania, where I teach, people going through the finest products of our educational system from the most elite homes in the sense of rich or culturally enriched or just very intellectually striving students, going through that process does not allow people to understand your work.
That's
true.
It
doesn't produce that. In fact, there's a great deal of, whether hostile or not, that process of elitist success is in many ways as exclusive, as contrary to understanding what you're doing and its difficulties as any other path.
Yes, but there's no denying that the work that I do, for all kinds of reasons, attracts a white middle-class, upper-middle-class audience. And I don't know how to, address that issue because I've got to do the kind of work I'm doing. But it is elitist in that sense, yes.
A lot of your work has to do with sexuality, and I wanted to ask you about the extent to which your male identity or your maleness has affected your work and your what you express or explore in your work.
Well, of course, I'm probably not the person to tell you, but because especially back in the 70s, the feminist movement was coming down, came down for a while pretty hard on me, saying that I was, you know, the play was from the chauvinist position of a male psyche. And I felt guilty for a while. Kate was always the lead in the plays, and she was generally beset by all these people exploiting her, sexually and otherwise. And I always said, well, but, you know, all I can do as an artist is to give evidence of where my head is at, and that's how it comes out. Then I felt so guilty that I tried consciously to change that a little and tried to make the female characters be a little more dominant and a little more active. And indeed, some feminists would come and say, oh, yeah, this play was much better. It's not as sexist. But I'm not sure how artificial that move was. I mean, I am a man, and so I make plays and art from the position of my male consciousness. Now, if I were making a different kind of art that I'm not particularly interested in, that was a more obviously socially oriented art, maybe you could make more of a conscious effort to show things, to tell a story from a woman's point of view and other kinds of things. But that's not what I'm doing. I'm just letting what wants to come through me come through me.
And what comes through you in its expression of heterosexual male desire is not particularly happy in most circumstances.
No, that's true. That's true. Well, I think the only playwright that I
was... you know Robert Bly, getting in touch with our iron fathers and feeling good about being men when we see your work. Actually, it's kind of repulsive, the aspects of male identity.
Well, I must admit that, you know, for many years I thought Brecht was the only person in the whole history of the West who ever wrote decent plays. Brecht had his own problems vis-a-vis women. But I don't think that much of Brecht anymore. And now the only playwright that I can abide in, you know, 2,000 years of Western drama is Strindberg. I guess that answers the question.
What's happened with your turn away from Bertolt Brecht?
Oh, I don't know. It just became too predictable to me, too self-evident, too kind of cut and dry.
You directed famously Raoul Julia cast in the Threepenny Opera at Lincoln Center, and that was a part of your life when you were doing operas and plays.
Yeah.
Leaving aside the practical constraints of where you're going to put your time and where you want to be physically, is that something that would interest you or still interest you to direct the plays of other people or operas of other composers and librettists?
It's hard for me to answer. Maybe if the right circumstance arose. But, you know, I doubt it. I suspect that the person who would respond to that would be the little Richard who was still, you know, upper-middle-class Jewish boy whose parents wanted him to be a big success. And so, you know, be glamorous and be a kick. I mean, that's why I did it in those days, too. That is not where my heart lies. That work does not serve the real deep me. That serves the ego in me, period.
Was there any work that you did as a director that did?
Yes, Kathy Acker. Twice I did Kathy Acker's material. Once an opera that Peter Gordon wrote the music for, David Sally did the scenery, created a big scandal when it was presented here at BAM. People were throwing things at the stage. I did an adaptation by myself of her My Death, My Life by Pier Paolo Pasolini, which both Kathy and I thought was more successful. But both times I felt that I was on home ground, on home turf, you know, dealing with her material.
Early on you worked with amateur, let's say, unschooled actors. So now you mostly work with trained actors. Are there advantages to each? Does your view about that change over time?
Well, I started working with untrained actors because I was sick and tired of going to the theater and seeing, as I've said so many times, that race of human beings on the stage called actors, just like they're Jews, they're Frenchmen, they're actors. And I wanted to see somebody else on stage. So I cast my friends, my awkward friends, my whatever friends. Then Kate, who was not an actress, developed her own intense technique, and just the other people sort of were blasted off the stage by her presence, and I needed a different kind of energy and focus to confront her and to deal with her, so I started using actors. And of course, if I'm doing text, and my plays then developed, the texts themselves became more complex, and more of them were spoken by the people on stage, and for that, the better actor I can get, the better. Since I've made this move into film as backdrop, I'm using less and less live text on stage, and so I'm going back to using not exactly non-professional actors, but less experienced actors, and who are more flexible and more willing to not get their moment in the sun, as it were.
Do you think it's possible to find actors now in New York who are less trained to speak as actors, looking at you and responding?
Yes, but you know, it's funny. I've done all kinds of plays for big producers, for myself. The verbal thing is still a big issue, because when you're auditioning for a normal play and you sit there for a month seeing 50 people a day, 30 people a day, lots of times somebody will walk in the door and you'll think, oh my God, this is an interesting person. And then they pick up a script and start to talk. Forget it. Forget it.
Well, that interests me a lot also in respect to poetry readings. And I don't want to have you leave close listening without asking you about the sound and your own way of reading and performing, which is very distinctive.
Yeah.
A text. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's one crucial layer in much of your work. And you did a reading, doing two readings for us today on close listening.
Well, I record a lot of my text talking close to the mic in a very deep voice, so it sounds like God a little bit, I suppose. And I guess I want to hear God talking.
Is that what God sounds like?
Well, I think of Julian James talking about how, you know, his theory that bicameral mind and that back in the days of the Greeks, people used to really hear a voice sounding in their head. Who knows what it sounded like? But whenever I wrote plays when I was a young man, I heard my mother's voice reading the plays because she used to read stories to me as a kid. So I rewrote and rewrote and rewrote to get rid of my mother's voice. And now I tape a lot of the dialogue by myself, and maybe I'm just trying to get a voice that sounds as far from my mother's voice as possible. Not that I didn't love my mother, but I thought, you can't be a serious playwright and sound like your mother. You know?
that deep voice is... It's like without place, or coming from,
yes.
You say, no body in the
normal theater that I reject, you watch the actor and you look past what they're saying to the intention, to what they're trying to achieve. And I think one of the things I'm doing, I'm sure it's overdetermined, is using that deep voice which blocks you from listening to the intention of the words and listen to the clang, clang, clang of each word as it hits the ear.
Right now you're working on something you called earlier, Wake Up, Mr. Sleepy, Your Unconscious Mind is Dead. When you work on those things, you're also composing not only words and thinking of acting in the theatrical theatrical work with the actors, but also the physical space of the stage and images. Any images coming to mind with that you're thinking about right now?
Oh, well, the set is designed already. You know. Yes, I have images. The big image, there's an airplane, an old-fashioned airplane suspended over the set with people staring out of it because I've always wanted to use, when I was a kid, I had a dream that I climbed up from this big pit and there was this airplane with people staring out of it, and from their eyes to me were dotted lines. And needless to say, in my plays, for years I've used dotted lines of string. So coming home to roost in this plane.
You've been listening to Richard Foreman, live at the Clock Tower Studios in Lower Manhattan. Our program was recorded on May 10, 2006. Close Listening is a production of WPS1.org in collaboration with Penn Sound. For more information on this show, visit our website, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. This is Charles Bernstein, who makes a practice, but not a habit, of close listening.